So this is the third day of this four-day retreat here in Tampa, Florida at the Franciscan Center, where we are bathing in the teachings of both ancient and some fairly current masters of the Dharma, practitioners who have made the practice of Dharma, the study of Dharma, and fortunately for us, the teaching of Dharma as the most important thing in their life. Took the teachings about the preciousness of this human birth, took the teachings on the inherent dissatisfactions and sufferings of samsara, teachings on karma, cause and effect, teachings on the altruistic mind and bodhicitta quite seriously, and made the decision to devote their life to it. We are very fortunate they have shown us the way, set an example to us. Concurrently with the teachings, in our meditations, we have been cultivating mindfulness and concentration, samatha, in terms of samatha, being very continuous and devoted to practicing various types of samatha with an object and without an object. And last night in our meditations, we began to look to practice what is called vipassana, or insight, deep looking, beginning to look directly into the mind to see, to get a better understanding of this mind and thoughts, and these things we call habit energy, to see what they are and what they're not. It is an unfolding. So before we continue on, bathing in the wisdom of the Dharma rain, are there any questions about anything that has been either in the meditations or in the talks from the last few days that, that people really have a meaningful question about? Brian. Oh, you do too. You got to put your hands together like this. Yes, Brian.
Last night you mentioned in the Dzogchen tradition that samatha and vipassana, I forget how you said it, the union of the two, and that they arise simultaneously. And I was wondering if you could explain that.
I'll just say a little bit, since this is recorded for anybody. It means many things, but so the question is that I'd mentioned yesterday about the union of samatha and vipassana in the Dzogchen tradition and also in the Zen tradition. Traditionally, they are taught sequentially, right? So first one cultivates mindfulness, then one cultivates single point of concentration, and then one cultivates insight. But in the Zen and the Dzogchen tradition, they are done simultaneously, right, at the same time. So therefore, we could say what we did last night, right, where we were looking directly into the nature of the mind, looking directly into the nature of thought or habit energy, we were concentrating, we were very single-minded, right? So in that case, the stability and the concentratedness of the mind, the single-pointedness of the mind, and the deep looking could occur simultaneously. They're not separate. They're not separate states, right? And oftentimes in traditional Buddhism, many people would practice concentration to achieve various states, the jhanas, you know, the various kinds of states, right, of concentration and samadhi. But in Zen and Dzogchen, because the emphasis is really not so much on cultivating state-specific states of concentration, but on you know, cultivating, really looking for a breakthrough, you know, to break out of our you know, the normal place we stay, which is in the realm of duality, in the realm of self, and then we look out through that, even into the Buddha's teachings, even into empty, you know, we're always doing it from being in here, right? We don't step out there. It's a little scary. As Rich said, doesn't the whole vastness belong to me? I don't know. You know, God, if it didn't belong to me, then what am I? Yes.
Scary indeed. I'm confused now about there were, yes, I think I experienced what one might call a breakthrough. I'm confused now about memory, which I know is a form of thought, right? But memory that has to do with, let's say, somebody you loved, right? And if that's merely a thought, did that person ever exist?
So the question is memory. And if memory is just another one of these mind fabrications, like thought, like perception, like beliefs, I mean, it's all, right? Does that mean that person I loved, who was, I would imagine has died, doesn't exist?
Didn't exist.
Well, didn't exist. When we find a you know, a tree down in the forest, it's been uprooted, it's just laying there, it's just wood, we might say it no longer has an existence as being a living thing, right? That is true, isn't it? But the we might say the skeleton that's left, like the skeleton of a human being, is a sign that at some point something exists, but they don't exist now. Right? I mean, that's true. You know, memories are like photo albums. They're just a little more, they can be a little more dynamic, but even a photo album, you can look at it even though it's one-dimensional and have emotions or feelings that remind you of something, but the truth is, yes, that's the truth. Things don't exist. They exist for a moment, right? A thought exists for a moment, a feeling exists for a moment, a world exists, you know? Even though we may say this world has been, I don't know how many, around for millions and millions of, I don't know, billions, what? 4.4 billion. But, you know, which sounds like big, right? Like a long time. But in the sense of the universe and the cosmos and the whole, it's like nothing, right? The existence of this world is like nothing. It's a blip. And that's the truth. And that, you know, is very humbling. And it puts things in perspective. But, you know, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, the role of the absolute. But from the point of view of the personal, right, which is also the world of form, the relative world, you have a memory of that person. And that's, you know, a precious memory to you or something. It doesn't mean you can't have it knowing the truth that whatever that was in reality no longer is. It is now just a memory, right? And it may, but oftentimes people are within us who have passed, not only as memories, because we inter are and, in a certain sense, we are them, and they are us, too. you know, and in a very practical way, you might find yourself thinking something or enjoying something, and you realize, oh, that's them. Right? Or you might be listening to a piece of music that you used to listen with them. They're, you know, they're really still hearing it. It's hard to explain. Because we so identify ourselves as physical beings. We so identify ourselves with the body, right? So that when the body is no longer there, you know, we really think the person has gone, and in a certain sense, the person has gone. They are dead. But yet, in truth, they never were really separate from us. And the mind that saw them is the same mind that they saw me. So it still continues. You know, they're listening to the music with you, still. They never were separate. We just thought they were. That's why we get so upset at loss, because we identify people with their bodies. We think that's all they are, but they're much more than that. You know, just the way we are much more than that. And when we understand that, we understand the passage of the body is just the natural order of things. But in a sense, there is a timeless connection that we have with all life. Yeah, I mean, it is humbling to realize we're just a blip. And that's the truth. That one day, you know, we'll just be, you know, they'll be burning us, or they'll be burying us, right? And for a while they may mourn us, but over time they won't. And over time, you know, will be a memory or a photo. And that's the truth, isn't it? But that's okay. The flower doesn't mourn as its petals drop. It's just the natural order of things. And as Thich Nhat Hanh says over and over again, you know, the petals that drop become the soil that becomes the basis for new life. It continues. So good. Let's listen to the real masters. This is Nyoshal Ken Rinpoche. He didn't die too long ago. Actually, I never met him, but he actually taught in the West a little bit. 1999, born in 32. Since childhood, he felt a great interest in the Dharma. He studied with 25 masters and spent many years in meditation retreat. He received from his master the great transmission of pith teachings of the great perfection, which he made the heart of his practice in teaching and passed on to many disciples, including the masters of his time. In 1959, he narrowly managed to escape from Tibet and sought refuge in India, where he lived in extremely difficult conditions, begging in the streets of Calcutta in order to survive. If anybody's been to Calcutta, you know it. That's no picnic. And then he started teaching again, sometimes with the Lama, sometimes to large crowds. Great teachers invited him to come and teach. Spent much of his latter part of his life in the West, especially in France. He says, why is bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment, so important? Okay, so bodhicitta is this mind of enlightenment, the mind that seeks enlightenment, which is no different than the mind of enlightenment. Right? It's the enlightened mind that thinks to know itself and manifests itself. The energy in the Mahayana behind that that drive is not only one's own personal liberation, but most importantly, to be of benefit to others, because one understands that everyone is, as somebody said yesterday, everyone is caught in this ignorance. It's a shared delusion. Right? So why is it so important, this thought of enlightenment, this wanting to benefit others? Because it is the immediate antidote, for the attachment to that sense of I, that is the origin of samsara, the cycle of suffering. Clear? On one hand is the attachment to self, to I, to me, and wanting, and the purpose of life being to satisfy me. And bodhicitta is the opposite. The purpose of life is to benefit and satisfy others. The unfounded belief in an illusory self, unfounded, we talked about that last night in the meditation, unfounded, it really doesn't have a foundation to it. And the illusory self, illusory again, doesn't mean it doesn't appear. But when it's investigated, it sees there's nothing there of any solidity. Buddhism doesn't say that the self doesn't have an apparent reality. Right? Everything that appears in the world, all phenomena have an apparent reality, a temporary reality in the realm of cause and effect. But that's all. There is no permanent solidity to anything, physical or mental. That is the nature of reality. The unfounded belief in the illusory self pushes us to cherish ourselves and to reject others, which finally turns against us and is the main cause of our suffering in samsara. Okay? So this emphasis on me, this rejection of the other, while it begins very simply, because it becomes the basis of a life, of our life and our actions and our thoughts, eventually it becomes a very source of the suffering of self, of the aloneness of self, of the affliction emotions of self, right? And that's in our ignorance. We think by always trying to satisfy the self, to get it comfortable, to get its needs met, to keep it safe, to advance it, to get it love, to get it this, to get it money, to get it, you know, any pleasure. You know, we think that's going to give it fulfillment and happiness, and all it does is just drive the stake in deeper. It is therefore essential to meditate all the time on love and compassion until we love others more than ourselves. That is the lifeblood of our spiritual practice and must always remain so. Okay, is that clear? So this is not a retreat on love and compassion and altruistic view. We've done many like that, but it's good to mention it. You know, see, it's interesting. Gunther yesterday, or a couple of days ago, Gunther, in terms of the planet and sustainability, right? He talked about choices from the point of view of really self. You know, I want to go here, I want to go there, but at the same time, I really care about the sustainability of the planet, global warming, etc. And I realize, oh, you know, these choices that I'm making for me. Our choices, you know, which in the bigger picture, I could be making other choices. And we talked about that and how, you know, how good that is that we think that way. But that's just one example, you see. In the mindfulness trainings as given in the Plum Village tradition, Thay said, in the training on generosity, he said, "What? We should freely give our time, energy, and material resources." So, you know, how often, when we make the choices and decisions in our life, do we make it just about me, or do I make it in consideration of others? Right? You know. Whether it's you know, what are we, you know, going out to dinner, you know, if we have disposable income, I feel like remodeling my house, remodeling the bathroom, buying the latest toy and gadget, getting a new, you know, new this, you know, we make decisions all the time in terms of ourselves. But do we do that in the sense of, oh, you know, am I aware that in how I use my wealth, my money, I'm just doing it for me, or could I be doing it, could I be using this for others, to benefit others, right? Time, energy, you know, with my time. We always like to make sure that we have enough time to what? To do all the things that we want to do. I mean, I'm just saying, if you think about what goes on in our mind, that's what's going on all the time. You know? Me. You know, I need time for me. But do we ever think, do we ever see of our time as something that we can be generous with? Generous means we go beyond ourselves and our own needs. That's what generosity means. Right? It means I freely am open and give to others, and I see their needs as equal, if not more equal, than mine. And why does he say we should, you know, cherish others more than ourselves? Right? I mean, most of us would go, ooh, I don't know about that one. Can I cherish myself and others? Right? But cherishing others more than myself, they're really... Because the interesting thing, my friends, is cherishing others more than oneself, doing for others more than oneself, actually leads to a greater happiness than always doing for me. Because when you do for you, the happiness is very short-lived. Right? It usually doesn't go much beyond the experience itself. And maybe there'll be a glow for a few hours or a few days. But when you make it in the habit of always thinking of others, whether it's your wealth, whether the decisions you make about how you use your wealth, your time, your energy, you are building a karma, a cumulative transforming transformation which supports your aspiration and softens the mind. You know, we talked about, you know, you got to soften the leather before it's usable. Right? Acting in a generous and compassionate and loving way softens the heart, softens the mind. And it is our deeply held attachment to ourself which is the source of our suffering. Again, if you look at your suffering, it's always connected to the I thought. It's always connected to the I thought. Your angers, your fears, your irritations, your hurts, they're always about who? Me. Try having an afflictive emotion without a me. Try it. That's a challenge. I mean, you can't have it. It's always I. I don't like that. I didn't get this. You know? I wanted this to happen. I don't want that to happen. I want them to be like this. I need this. I need that. I mean, it's always connected to the I thought. Is that clear? Well, what if you didn't have the I thought? Where would your afflictive emotions take root? So again, that is why in this path, it is not just a path of wisdom and meditation, it is a path of love, it's a path of compassion, it's a path of generosity, it's a path of selfless service. You know, they are the same path. And they feed each other. the more we see into the nature of self, the more we see into the nature of mind, the freer we are in our attachment at a deep level of our own mind to this illusory self, the natural openness will occur. Because you won't experience yourself as separate from. And in the center of your mind will not be enshrined I. We don't realize that for many of us we have an altar in our own minds. And it's not the Buddha's picture on the altar. It's a picture that looks very much like each of us. That's where we're worshiping all day. And we have to decide whether that really has brought us happiness in any deep and meaningful way. So we are reminded. Nyendrak Lungrig Nima. Let's see who this is. I don't know him. Obviously, Matthew Ricard didn't know him either. All he says is, I mean, there's little descriptions of most of them, but all he says is 19th century. So obviously, this little scrap of teaching or something or poem remains, but obviously, one of the things that, of course, happened with the Chinese taking over of Tibet and the destruction is that, much has been lost. Much has been recovered, was hidden away, but much more has been lost, destroyed, because the Chinese communists were very efficient in their destruction of monasteries, of monastery libraries, burning all the teachings, using them for waste paper. I mean, it was quite deliberate. So, now we are going a little deeper. Bear with me. Although subject and object are not two, and again, these are written like verses. I don't know if they're like poems. Much was written this way. Although subject and object are not two, they appear to us as fundamentally distinct entities. And through attachment to them, we further strengthen this tendency. Samsara is nothing but that. Okay, so for those who hear about sort of samsara and nirvana, samsara is the world of suffering, the world of delusion, right? Nirvana is, the place of freedom and the cessation of suffering, the world of enlightenment. He's saying, samsara is nothing but our attachment to our dualistic view of reality. Rather than seeing the empty nature of all phenomena, rather than seeing the non-self nature of our mind, rather than seeing I and you and me and we as simply mental fabrications that we place on a reality that is essentially indivisible, we actually believe our elaborations of our mind and these labels that we give on things. And then we are attached. Especially we are attached to the I thought and everything that now has come to surround it. And this is strengthened through life, strengthened, decade after decade of decade. And therefore it seems so real and solid at this point in our life. While good and bad actions are devoid of true reality, by the power of our intention they produce joys and sorrows. Just as seeds of sweet or bitter plants give fruits of corresponding taste. So intrinsically, what we label a good action and a bad action are both empty of any permanence or solidity of any inherent reality at all. They are over as soon as they are done. They have no permanent existence, but yet they have effects. Yet they have effects. And in terms of an individual, the intention, the energy that was behind the action is what is imprinted in our minds, which is then continuing a stream of contributing to our karma. Right. Actions in themselves are just actions, he's saying. They're just actions. Right? But the intention behind them, if it's a selfish intention, it reaps a selfish result. In my mind, if it's an altruistic intention, I'm creating altruistic karma in my mind. Okay. If I am outwardly doing a generous act, but inwardly I'm just doing it for a selfish motive, the karma I'm creating is one of selfishness. The karma I'm continuing is one of selfishness, even if outwardly the act appears good. Okay. Acts are what they are. Right? You know, if I accidentally kill somebody, right? There's no really negative personal karma in that because it's a pure accident. I didn't intend it. I mean, it's a tragedy for the person who was killed, etc. It's not saying that, but in terms of karma. But on the other hand, right, if I acted with malice, if I act as with a negative intention of wanting to do harm, right, then I have created a very significant karma for myself. That's what he's saying. Seeds of sweet and bitter plants give fruits of the corresponding taste. Again, this is why the cultivation of bodhicitta, the cultivation of the altruistic mind, the cultivation of the selfless mind, the cultivation of the paramitas of generosity, etc., etc., these are all about changing our karma so we have a different mind. It's not just a little different mind, it's a big different mind. Because when self is no longer enshrined in the altar of your heart-mind, no matter how outwardly nice you appear. But when you've kind of taken that one out, and in the altar of your heart you've enshrined, other beings. And you've enshrined the Buddha, and meaning a representative of your own enlightened nature, then one acts in very different ways than one did, and one has a very different mind. In fact, even if one goes to hell or elsewhere, it is only a change in one's perception of the world, as in dreams, where the things that appear do not exist. The root of all our illusory perceptions is the mind. There are many people who are in hell right now. Right. There are many people who are hungry ghosts right now. There are many people who live an animal existence right now. There are many people who are titans right now. They live for only power over and fame and money. And there are people who live for celebrity, etc., and ease and, this is all going on right now because of their minds. Their outward manifestation of the world is an outward manifestation of human minds. That is why it is so important that we understand that the world will never change unless the minds and hearts of human beings change. That is why, for those who are activists and into politics, you find it is such a slippery slope. Every time you think you made a little gain over here, you lose it over here. Right? And it's not like you're doing something wrong. I mean, people think, oh, I'm doing something wrong. You know, let's get together, have a conference, and come up with a new strategy. Right? The fundamental is wrong. That doesn't mean you don't do your best to relieve the suffering of others and to make a better world, but we know, you know, that as long as people's minds are enshrouded in duality, as long as people cherish themselves more than other beings, and then they just manifest it. They cherish themselves, they just cherish their tribe, their family, their religion, their ethnic group, their gender. I mean, it just goes on and on. But it's all coming from the same place. Delusion. They don't see the interconnection with life. If you don't see the interconnection of life, if you don't understand that the trees are breathing for us, you know, if you don't see the earth as a living organism that we are deeply connected to, you know, that we are of the earth. Our body is made up of elements, you know, solid elements and minerals and liquid and air. I mean, we are not different than the earth. And yet, because we are so separate from and live in this delusion of separateness, you know, we think that is something there just to satisfy me. Right? You know, indigenous people knew differently. They were connected. So they, you know, they used the things of the earth, but they understood their connection to it. You know, people these days, they're so alienated. They don't understand it, do they?
Seems like language. We have to be very careful about language.
Yeah, language is the way we describe reality. Right thought is very important. To use language in a way that is accurate for describing reality. Yeah, I mean, if you pay attention to, you know, what's going on in politics, I mean, there's no connection between language and reality. Right? I mean, reality doesn't almost even matter anymore, does it? It's all about language. I mean, it's again, where does that come from? It only comes from people who are deeply ignorant. Ignorant, I'm not calling them ignorant like bad, but ignorant of just now having no understanding of anything. And the danger is when you have widespread ignorance combined with very devious, corrupt, self-serving leadership, watch out. You get a world like we have, right? Because there's no check. You know, the wonderful thing about the process of meditation and mindfulness, the wonderful thing about a wonderful Dharma, and again, I don't say wonderful Dharma, you know, here we're in a Catholic church. I mean, I think, the new Pope, his name is, I mean, what a Bodhisattva, right? I mean, it's like, there it is. God, you know, out of that group of cardinals comes a Bodhisattva. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, who speaks what? Who speaks accurately? Who calls things what they are? You know, and we go, wow. You know, it's like, and the only reason we go, wow, is why? It's so rare these days. You know, it's like, right? You know, just another thing popped in about generosity. You know, it was interesting when I lived with the Tibetans who loved the Dharma. I mean, this was a popular and deeply respected the Dharma and the institutions of Dharma and the people who practiced Dharma. And it was, you know, the common thread for lay people was when they had surplus wealth, they offered it to the Dharma. I mean, it was just incredible. You know, offer it to the monastery, support somebody going on retreat, build a new this, you know, do that. I mean, they understood the value and that wealth should be used to benefit society. Now, there was something they did unfortunately miss in their generosity, that they didn't have that sense of helping their fellow man, I think, which is much more developed in the Judeo-Christian tradition. I mean, they were so focused on the power of the Dharma to transform that oftentimes they kind of were too accepting. But again, I think you think in modern-day teachers like the Dalai Lama, that has changed. Anyhow. The nature of mind, and again, last night a few maybe got a little sense of what the nature of mind is. Transcends the notions of existence and non-existence, eternity and nothingness. In other words, nothing can be said about it. To this nature is given the simple name, absolute space. We have to call it something. That space in itself, perfectly pure, that immaculate sky, empty and luminous with no center or periphery, has always been in the heart of everything, its face obscured by the temporary veil of mental constructs. And we talked about this a little yesterday. You know, why don't we see it? If it's the basis of everything, if it is my fundamental nature, if absolute space is the fundamental nature of my mind, why don't I see it? Because all day long, what are we doing? Chasing our thoughts. You know, what are we doing all day long? Chasing our thoughts. As I said last night, living on a gold planet all day long, what are we looking for? A little nugget. I mean, we live on a planet of solid gold, and I'm looking for a nugget. I mean, isn't that fundamentally insane? It's right here, and yet we just chase our thoughts, chase our concept, chase our need, chase our wants. Last night, we stopped and turned and started looking into our minds. Looking into thoughts, looking into our habit energies, looking into self. That's where you're going to discover the space. You're not going to discover it chasing concepts. Because that is what is obscuring it. That's why we can't think our way into enlightenment. All thoughts, even Dharma thoughts, even Buddhist thoughts, are not it. Right? Finger pointing at the moon. It's not the finger, it's the moon. Thoughts of the finger. It is hard to put an end by force to the continuous chain of thoughts. Right? If anybody's ever tried to stop their thoughts, you realize it is hard. Hard meaning it'll never happen. But if, when they occur, their nature is recognized, thoughts have no choice but to be liberated in their own sphere. This is a very cogent teaching in the Dzogchen tradition. Right? And this is what we practiced a little bit last night. Just a little bit. Right? But when you look right at them and they reveal their nature, what is their nature? Empty, impermanent, nothing there. In that moment, right, Rich? In that moment, you had a moment of liberation, right? Habit, energy, thoughts, Rich, for that moment gone, and you felt, oh, at ease. It's like that. Without pursuing past thoughts or inviting future thoughts, remain in the present moment and simply recognize the nature of whatever arises in your mind. This is the practice, and the most fundamental, direct way in Zen and Dzogchen. This is the advice of the masters. Once you stop your pursuit of thoughts, how do we stop the pursuit of thought? Through the practice of mindfulness and concentration. Right. What that helps us bring it to a point where we have stopped that pursuit, then we can look right at whatever arises and see its nature. And then rest in that, remain in that. And he says, relax in simplicity, free of intentions and attachments. Now maybe if you're a beginner, you can rest like that for how long? What? A second? Maybe a second. Anybody give me 10 seconds? 20 seconds? 3 minutes? 5 minutes? 10 minutes? 30 minutes?
How do we know?
How do you know what?
How much time has passed?
Look at your watch. And then it starts up again, right? And then you just do it again. Do it again. That's the practice. Although there is nothing to meditate on, remain fully present without getting distracted. There's no solid thing to meditate on at this level of practice, right? But you got to stay present. You know, the watchman has to be there. Or else it's very easily, whatever passage of time has been, you're off again. Right? So, once again. Remain fully present without getting distracted. By getting used to the way things occur of themselves without altering anything, primordial wisdom, self-luminous, will arise from within. Again, it is hard for us, even though we've read it and heard it, to actually believe that we have this luminous clarity as the basis of our mind, and we have this incredible richness of knowing and wisdom that is inseparable from our mind's nature. And if we just get out of the way, it will come forth. We hear about our innate wisdom, right? But we don't believe it. But it is the truth. It will arise from within. You don't have to make it arise. Okay. You just got to open up the channel. Okay. You open the channel. How do you open the channel? Mindfulness, concentration, deep looking, deep penetration. You look into your mind. You look into your thoughts. You look into the nature of self. And in that brief moment of experience, there is an opening. But it has to be continuous. So the opening stays and gets larger, and the larger the opening, the more ability your luminous, knowing nature can just come through. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Dalai Lama, all these masters are not who they are because they have a PhD in Buddhism. there are many sharp people, both in the Buddhist world and in the academic world, right, who have a lot of knowledge about Buddhism, can speak quite eruditely about Buddhism and Buddhist teachings and Buddhist concepts and Buddhist meditation and Buddhist states of realization. But people of realization, and especially people of deep realization, have something else. Right? And when you're in the presence of that, you know that. The Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh, they're one of thousands of Buddhist monks. Right? There are thousands of them. Right? Just like them. Wear the same robes, you know, shave their heads. What's the difference? It's their awakened mind. It's their knowing. And in their skillful capacity to recognize the needs and the proclivities of sentient beings and to guide them along the way. And that does not come from studying Buddhist texts. There is a natural knowing. Again, you know, we chant in the morning, trust in mind. And then for pages it goes on. Poor guy. Every way he could possibly explain it to us. The third Zen patriarch, Chan patriarch, he's explaining it to us. Right? Why do you think he goes on? Page after page. It's like this, it's like this, it's like this, it's like this. This. It's like hoping of the thousands of people who hear it, maybe this little couplet will strike home. And you go, oh, now I get it. Primordial wisdom, self-luminous, will arise from within. How is it so, you might ask, if you leave cloudy water undisturbed, it will naturally become clear. Most other meditations are only temporary ways to calm the mind. The space of great changing emptiness and the simple luminosity of uninterrupted wakeful presence have always been inseparable. You must yourself experience that essential thing which is within you. No one else can do it for you. Here it is again. That's a responsibility. You know, I can imbibe the teachings, I can have wonderful teachers, I can listen to wonderful teachings, I can have all the freedoms and opportunities to practice the leisure, have a nice sitting cushion, you know, have a nice place, you know, everything. What's missing? Me, I'm not present to all that. You know, I gotta show up for all that. I gotta show up for my precious human birth. Or it's a waste. You see? Each of us have to, that's what he's saying. No one can do it for us. We have to show up for our opportunities in life. We have to show up if we have gifts. Gifts of our mind, gifts of our heart, gifts of our material resources. We need to show up and use them wisely and intelligently and compassionately. We can't let them use us. So, you know, in this path, and there are many paths give us a deity or something outside ourselves that we can call upon. But in Zen and Dzogchen, which is pointing directly to the mind nature, directly to the inherent freedom and luminosity of our own mind nature. It's saying, you know, because the treasure is within, only we can unlock it. You know, we can get lots of support and guidance and help right up to the edge of the pool. But the, you know, right, or the diving board, right? But that first time, right? Anybody remember that first time? You know, when you didn't know what was going to happen. And you're alone out there. There it is, you know. It's up to you now. No one can do it for you. It's your experience. It's like that. Are there any questions? And then I just want to read a little thing by Jensi Rinpoche. And then we'll end for the day. Yeah, I think it's all pretty clear. It just has to be practiced, you know. We want to make sure, that's why I always say, is it clear? Because I want to make sure the instructions are clear. You know, then it's just a matter of doing it. You know, traditionally, you know, most practitioners often didn't live close to their teacher and have ongoing relationship with their teacher. Only a few did. I mean, for many practitioners, they see their teacher, they get their instructions, and they go off and do it. They maybe see the teacher, you know, at some point later, weeks later, months later, even years later. Depending on how isolated they were. So this is Jensi Rinpoche. Remember I mentioned the day, almost 7 foot. Great, great Buddha of our age. Those who were fortunate to encounter him were lucky. This is a little longer. This is more like a couple of paragraphs. Let me see how far we'll get. It's dealing with the things we've been talking about already today. It's good to hear it in different ways. To take the uncreated stronghold of the nature of mind, you have to go to the source and recognize the very origin of your thoughts. You've heard that before now. You know what we're talking about. Otherwise, one thought, you see, it's going in the other direction, you see. When a thought arises, look right at it, to see what it is, to see where it's coming from, right? That's where we look. He says, otherwise, one thought will give rise to a second, then a third, and so on. In no time, you will be assailed by memories of the past, anticipation of the future, and the pure awareness of the present moment will be completely obscured. Everybody knows what he's talking about, okay? If you recognize the emptiness of your thoughts instead of solidifying them, the arising and subsiding of each thought will clarify and strengthen your realization of emptiness. So, you know, there's, you know, Alex, there's the moment in terms of your two evolutionary paths. It's right there, right? Right? If when that thought arises, whatever it is, you recognize the nature of it, and you go to the source, that's one path. That's the path directly into the luminous, vast space of your true mind. On the other hand, if you start chaining your thoughts, as it said, one after the other, you're just solidifying, reifying the cocoon. It is our own mind that leads us astray into the cycle of existence. Blind to the mind's true nature, we fixate on our thoughts, which in truth are simply the manifestations of that nature, because thoughts come from our true nature and are not separate from our true nature, and yet because we live in duality, we see them as these separate real objects to be either liked or disliked, accepted or rejected. You know, but through fixation, pure awareness is frozen into solid concepts such as self, other, desirable, repulsive, and many more. This is how we create samsara. Okay. Is that clear? I mean, this is very intimate. This is so clear and direct. We're just talking about the human experience of each of us. This is nothing foreign, nothing unknown. Yes. Again, because of this, if our fundamental nature is pure, what's with these impure thoughts? Again, from the point of absolute truth, there's no such thing as an impure thought. All thoughts have the nature of emptiness. All thoughts are of the nature of this luminous mind. I mean, thoughts arise in the mind. They are of the mind. Try to have a thought outside your mind. Try that one. We laugh, it's right. So all thoughts are of the mind. The purity and impurity are whether they are, you know, this is in terms of judgment, right? An impure thought is a thought where the basic reality of how things are is misperceived, and therefore it is a thought that is solidifying, reifying, and taking us in an afflictive way. That's an impure thought. It's not, its nature is impure. It's how it's manifesting. It leads us, you know, it's like, what's a bad friend? Well, it's a friend who gives us bad advice. You know what I'm saying? It's in relationship to that, right? They may be a friend, but they give us, you know, they're a bad friend these days. They're giving us bad advice. Okay, so it is a kind of a judgment, right? So impure and pure really has to do, you know, which a pure thought is a thought that is congruent with the way things are. It is a thought of loving kindness, of compassion, which is expression of this interconnection of all life. We might say an impure thought is a selfish thought, a self-serving thought, because it's coming from ignorance, from this sense of a separate self and its truth. Okay? Somebody over here? Okay. Yeah. Okay, this is... Yeah. So again, that is why it is said in Dzogchen, take thoughts as the path of awakening. And we might say, what? Thoughts are the enemy. All right? I want to get rid of my thoughts. I want to, you know. But at this level of practice, all thoughts, it says take thoughts, all thoughts, because all thoughts, pure, impure, have the same nature. Right? And if you look directly into a pure thought, if you look directly into an impure thought, they all participate in the same empty nature. They're all entranceways into our true mind. So at this point of practice, which is a very deep practice, don't fool yourself, it's a deep practice, right? One, the mind is not disturbed by these various kinds of thoughts because one is not grabbing onto any of them, but using all of them as means of seeing clearly. Lakes and rivers can freeze in winter, and the water can become so solid that people, animals, carts travel back and forth on its surface. Those who live in Florida maybe haven't known that, but there is this thing called ice, and things, cold weather, things freeze over. I right? Just, you know, I want to make sure this isn't an analogy that maybe is particular to people who live in colder climes like Tibet. Okay, we might go, what's he talking about? Okay. As the approach of spring, the earth warms up and the waters thaw. What remains then of all that solid ice? Water is soft and fluid. Ice is hard and sharp. We cannot say they're identical, but neither are they different. Ice is only frozen water. And water is only melted ice. It is the same with our perceptions of the external world. Hakuin Zenji in the song of Zazen, it's like water and ice. Without water, no ice. Without sentient beings, no Buddhas. To be attached to the reality of phenomena, tormented by attraction and repulsion, obsessed by the eight worldly preoccupations, this is what causes the mind to freeze. Okay? Melt the ice of your concepts so that the fluid water of free perception can flow. Okay? That sort of answers. When we attach an inherent reality to our thoughts, when we grab at them, when we push away with them, whatever we do with them, we are freezing them. We are making them solid things. They are no longer fluid. They're no longer flowing. The practice of mindfulness, concentration, and deep looking in the way we're talking, this is what melts the concepts, right? You look at a concept, even a difficult concept. Rich last night looked at, didn't tell us what it was, but he looked at something that was, appeared to him really, ooh, this is solid and real, right? And yet when you stop and you just look at it, you go, you know, you made it melt, in the analogy he's doing. You made it melt. And all of a sudden, it was just fluid energy, right? Just by looking directly at it. This is what he's talking about. Melt the ice of your concept so that the fluid water of free perception can flow. Everything we experience, all the phenomena of samsara nirvana, appears with the vivid clarity of a rainbow, and yet, like a rainbow, is devoid of any tangible reality. Once you recognize the nature of phenomena manifest at the same time empty, your mind will be freed from the tyranny of delusion. Anybody want to overthrow the tyrant of delusion? This is the real tyrant that we need to be most concerned about. Worldly tyrants come and go. They certainly can do harm. But as long as the tyranny of delusion is operating in people's minds, things will not change. They cannot change. Right? Fruits are known by their seeds. The seed produces the fruit. Right? A loving, compassionate, caring world where people feel connected and want to take care of one another. Right? What's going to cause that to come into being? What are the seeds of that? It can't be legislated, unfortunately. So again, we have to look deeply and see the connection between social issues and social problems, environmental issues, environmental problems, and the minds of human beings. The creator of these problems. It's not like problems float around in some ether all by themselves and all of a sudden land. All right? It's not like that. Problems arise because of causes and conditions, and the causes and conditions are seeded in the minds of human beings. And that's, you know, that could be hard for some people, you know. Getting a piece of legislative passed is something tangible, you know what I'm saying? All right, there's an issue, get it done. Let's win it, get it on the ballot, done. Right? Unfortunately, you know, it doesn't work like that, does it? You know, 10 years later, they're overturning the... You know, it's like... That's what it's all about. Yes.
I can remember when they passed civil rights legislation, and I thought, what I'm so glad that's done with.
Yeah.
People's attitudes didn't change. That was what in the system was broken. I mean, it was in there, as you say, it was in their minds that changed.
Right. And that's just the truth, you know what I mean? You can, yeah, so just made a comment. That was more of a comment just about civil rights and when, you know, the great movement of civil rights and the passage of civil rights legislation, et cetera, end of segregation, desegregation, everybody thought, oh, racial problem, check that one off. You know, and here we are. 50 years later, 60 years later, you know, dealing with the same issues. And people go, you know, why is that? Well, it's because of the things we're talking about. You know, minds and hearts have to change. I mean, who said that? Some minds and hearts. But I mean, it's true. And that, unfortunately, takes more time. It takes dialogue. It takes communication. It takes religious institutions really teaching the Dharma. And I don't mean the Buddha Dharma. I mean the Dharma of truth, of love, of compassion, of connection. You know, that's why it's so wonderful to have somebody like Francis, you know, as head of the church. He's teaching the Dharma. He's doing his best, poor guy. But this is the only way it's going to happen. And it's slower this way. It's more incremental this way, but at least there's a solid foundation. You know, again, that is why, you know, we really need to support the Dharma in this world, support the institutions, the teachings of Dharma. It's not the only thing. Hopefully there are many other and other religious traditions, non-religious traditions, that are contributing to the transformation of the human mind. It really is essential these days. Human beings have unfortunately created great capacities for self-destruction, much more powerful than in the past. So. Yes?
Just a quick question. There's a line in one of the meal contemplations that I keep stumbling over every time. It's at the beginning of one where it says, we practice so that people won't be hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what we're talking about? Is that what you're talking about? I mean, because I work in agriculture, and so I'm like, it doesn't make sense. But is it saying that when we see our connection to each other, then we won't allow people to be hungry?
Yeah, I think it's you know, these are meal chants, and they are obviously... You know, like you're saying, the meal chants are teachings. They're taking this very simple, ordinary human experience of eating food and putting it in a bigger context. And the bigger context is about our mind. See, eating food is physical. I mean, that's all it is, right? So it's a physical way that we put fuel into our body. But, you know, through those meal gathas, it's helping us put food and eating into a much bigger context, which is obviously one of the contexts is what? There are many people on this planet who don't have any food or don't have enough food. So when we say, you know, it's sort of like what Gunther was saying. I mean, I don't think it's giving one answer, but it's saying be aware of this. You know, be aware that even though we, you know, have a full plate, and we can go back for seconds, right? Many, many people in the world do not even have the first full plate. And be aware that the food we're eating maybe has a relationship to that. You know, it's this inconnection, it's the same thing. It's kind of making us, helping us look more deeply into these actions we do and see interconnection. Right, to come out of this very narrow little world that we live in. Right? And to see the bigger picture. And again, I mean, it's, you might take that one way, somebody else might take it another way. The important thing is we use these meal chants to kind of look more deeply into life and these kinds of things. Yeah.